Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1038, interview number 8 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 4th of the year 2018, and it is my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jim DiEugenio, the author of Destiny Betrayed that we are speaking about, and also JFK, The Evidence. Today. Jim, welcome back.
Good evening, Dave.
We have been talking about the Paines and their background, and as I mentioned at the end of our previous interview, you conspiracy people, Alan Dulles was right, you conspiracy people sure did have a ball with his contacts with those peace-loving leftists, the Paines. And I think before we get into what those peace-loving leftists did, I'd like to ask you to review the family pedigree of those people, bearing in mind, too, that the Oswalds were handed over to them by George de Morenshield and the White Russian crowd in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Well, Michael Paine, as I noted in my book, comes from probably the oldest families in America. That is the Forbes and the Cabots up there, probably, I don't know, like early 1700s, late 1600s, they established their pedigree, all right, up there in Massachusetts Bay Colony. And at the time of the assassination, he was actually collecting checks from trust funds that he had from both of those families. His relatives, cousins and uncles, worked in the State Department. Cameron Forbes was the governor and ambassador to the Philippines. Thomas Dudley Cabot, Michael's cousin, was a former president of United Fruit Company. All right. Thomas's brother, John Cabot, was also in the State Department and exchanging information with Maurice Gatlin while the CIA was preparing its overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz, all right, in Central America. All right, now, those on one side. On the other side, you have Ruth's father, William Avery Hyde, who worked for the OSS during World War II and then went over the Agency for International Development, which had strong ties to the CIA, as an insurance commissioner, all right, and her sister, Sylvia Hyde Hoke, worked for the Central Intelligence Agency as a psychologist, all right? So, and her husband, John Hoke, worked for the AID, Agency for International Development, all right? So those are the kind of backgrounds we see when we explore who these people were, which you will not find, of course, in the Warren Commission report, okay? Now, some of the interesting things that we found out with the establishment of the ARB, okay, that is the commission that was tasked with declassifying documents as a result of Oliver Stone's film JFK. There was an FBI report about a man at a place called Luby's Restaurant, which is near SMU in Dallas. He would accost certain students and then praise the Castro Revolution to them while protesting America's policies towards Cuba. He then would claim to have a communist, an ex-Marine, who recently returned to the USA with a Russian wife, as being friends with this person, which, of course, was a clear reference to Oswald. This was in April of 1963. Now, you can imagine, of course, that the people running the restaurant thought this was kind of unusual for Dallas, Texas. A guy praising the Castro Revolution and knocking American policy. Well, the FBI came down, they did an investigation, and the students identified this guy as Michael Paine. Michael Paine. All right? So, interesting question, isn't it? What was a guy with the Cabots and the Forbes background working at helicopter under with a security clearance, be doing, you know, trying to engage students in those kind of discussions? Well, one of the answers might be that when Buddy Walters, who worked as a sheriff in a deputy in the sheriff's department, went in to search the Ruth Payne's garage, all right, one of the things he later talked about finding was several metal filing cabinets full of letters, maps, records, and index cards with names of pro-Castro sympathizers, all right? This was mentioned in a report by Sheriff Decker to the Warren Commission. It created quite a stir, and therefore the Warren Commission essentially made it go away in their speculation and rumors part of its report. So now, in my opinion, that's what Michael Payne was doing at Luby's restaurant, okay, collecting names of Castro sympathizers in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Now, why do I say that? Because in the 80s, that is what many people suspected that Ruth Payne was doing down in Nicaragua during the so-called Contra War against the Sandinista government. There was a woman named Sue Wheaton who remembered Ruth, okay? She was a volunteer for a religious group that backed the Sandinistas. She met Ruth as part of another group, but Ruth's group ran a sawmill project on the east coast of Nicaragua, which was a Contra holdout area and a nexus of CIA-based activities, all right? Whenever Wheaton would encounter Ruth, she said Ruth would be taking copious notes and be accompanied by others who would take snapshots and tape record the proceedings, all right? She concluded that Ruth was taking down information about Americans in Nicaragua who opposed U.S. policy and probably giving it to the American embassy, all right? Now, give you another example. It wasn't just these citizen witnesses who had suspicions. It was somebody in the government. When Marina Oswald testified before Jim Garrison's grand jury in the 60s, a member of the grand jury asked her if she was still associated with Ruth Payne. Marina replied she was not. When she was asked why, Marina said it was upon the advice of the Secret Service. She then said that they had told her it would not look good if the public found out that she, Ruth, had friends over there, and it would be bad for me if people found out the connection between me and Ruth and the CIA. An assistant DA then asked, in other words, you were left with the impression that she was in some way connected with the Central Intelligence Agency, to which Marina replied, yes. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to return to Nicaragua, there was a friend that Steve Jones discovered who went ahead and went to Costa Rica for some R&R with Ruth. When they arrived near the Costa Rican destination, some people approached a car to help them out. When they saw that it was Ruth, they walked away moaning, oh no, it's Ruth Payne, keep her away from us, she's CIA. It got so bad that the couple had to leave. When they got back to America, they remained in contact, and the woman actually won Ruth's confidence, okay? And she admitted to this person that her father, William Avery Hyde, had worked for the CIA, that she had an estranged daughter who would not talk to her until she came to grips with the, quote, evil she had done in her life. When the woman asked Ruth what evil, she clammed up, but it was in the context of discussing the Kennedy assassination, all right? Now, one of the things that Ruth did, as we know today...
Jim, I'd like to jump in just briefly.
Sure,
one of the things that resonates both between Michael Payne, apparently vacuum cleaning Castro sympathizers, and also with Ruth Payne, then later, decades later, performing intelligence on pro-Contra or anti-Contra activists in Nicaragua. That resonates strongly with what Guy Bannister, one of the things Guy Bannister was doing, and what Lee Harvey Oswald was apparently involved with at in the Newman Building, which was having some old Bannister, as you mentioned, and as we will come back to when we get to Garrison's actual investigation. Guy Bannister was infiltrating the pro-Castro groups and quote, leftist, unquote, student milieu, plural, and acquiring names for his files. I also note, you know, as we've had people like Ruth Payne active in the Iran-Contra or what became the Iran-Contra series of events, so to people like Felix Rodriguez, Luis Posada Carriles, and other Cuban expatriates who were involved with this, the same series of machinations also crop up in Iran-Contra, almost like the conga line ops here.
Yes, that's true. I would agree with all that.
And so Ruth, and with the remarkable connections of the Paynes and with what Marina Oswald was in, you know, mentioned when she was deposed by the Garrison grand jury about Ruth Payne and the CIA, some of what Ruth did with regard to the Oswalds. Go ahead.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Let's go into that.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things is that she and her husband were two of the very first people who attempted to link Oswald with the Edwin Walker shooting. So let me give you a little background on that. Okay. In April of 1963, someone took a pot shot at the home of General Edwin Walker, a famous right-wing reactionary part of the hard right movement within the United States, all right, and violently opposed to Kennedy. In fact, he had been at Ole Miss when the Kennedys were trying to integrate that college with James Meredith, and it turned into a kind of violent riot, all right. Now, that was in 62. Now, nobody, and the investigation had gone on for 7.5 months, nobody at the Dallas Police Department had ever intimated that Lee Harvey Oswald was a part of the Walker shooting. Okay? No one. All right? But now suddenly, first of all, Michael Payne says that there might be a linkage, and that story ran on the Houston Post on the 23rd, okay, November the 23rd, the day after the assassination. And then, about a few days after that, Ruth Payne transfers over to the Secret Service a typed-up letter in a couple of books that she said that Marina Oswald had to have. They were called Our Child, and the other was the Book of Helpful Instructions. All right, it was a note that was not dated, did not have Oswald's latent fingerprints on it. It took up about one side of a sheet of paper, all right? And none of the fingerprints on it matched Lee or Marina. But the Warren Commission used this as a somehow being a note that Lee left for Marina on the night that he went out and took a shot at Edwin Walker, all right? Now, I guess I should add in a little bit about the Walker shooting, why this makes no sense, because, first of all, there were two witnesses that the FBI and the Dallas police found, okay? One was an actual witness to the shooting, all right? He came out, he ran out of his apartment right after the shooting had occurred, and he got a look at the two guys who were running into their cars and leaving. His name was Kurt Coleman. All right, he said neither one of them was Oswald. Okay? There was another witness, Robert Suri, who had been there a couple nights before, and he saw two people casing Walker's house. And they had a car. The people with Coleman got away in two separate cars. He said that that wasn't Oswald. All right? Further, Oswald didn't drive, and he didn't have a car. Finally, the original ammunition taken from the shooting did not match up with the supposed Oswald rifle. Oswald's rifle used a 6.5-millimeter shell. Okay, this was a .30-06, plus the Oswald ammunition was supposed to be copper-coated, and the .30-06 was silver. So the coloring was different. So in other words, nothing connecting Oswald with the Walker shooting has any kind of forensic value. But here they are, desperately trying, the Paines especially, are trying to implicate him in the Walker shooting, okay? And I think one of the reasons they did this is because Oswald had no past history that would make it seem like he would go ahead and do what he did on November the 22nd, 1963. All right? Okay, now, also in the belongings was found a picture taken outside Oswald's home. Excuse me, Walker's home. So in other words, we're supposed to believe that he was kind of casing the house, right? Okay? Also, there was the photographs of Oswald with the alleged rifle and the alleged handgun holding up two communist magazines. All right? All this stuff is found in the Ruth Paine's garage, and all of it, and by the way, there was also some alleged artifacts from Mexico City, because the Warren Commission was having a very, very difficult time placing Oswald in Mexico. Well, Ruth comes up with things like a rules for betting card, use at a racetrack, okay, a Spanish-English dictionary with a handwritten note, okay, a bracelet that he was supposed to bought Marina, et cetera. Okay? Now, to show you how suspicious this was, when Ruth Paine transferred the alleged Walker shooting note to the Secret Service, they brought it back to her because they thought she typed it. This is how suspicious the Secret Service was of Ruth Paine and in the days following the Kennedy assassination. All right, let me bring up another point about this.
But before you continue, that picture of Oswald with the pistol that he allegedly used to shoot Patrolman Tippett, and the Mannlicher Carcano that he allegedly used to shoot President Kennedy, and you know the interesting shadows going different ways, and Oswald's body tipped over to one side, that appeared on the cover of Life magazine in the spring of 1964. So it wasn't like just this odd picture. It got national coverage and distribution.
Right. Now, I bring up a very serious problem with that picture, okay? Namely, that the camera that was supposed to be used to shoot that picture is called an Imperial Reflex camera. When you look at the Dallas Police inventory property list from the two-day searches of Ruth Paine's home, there is no Imperial Reflex camera in that list, all right? There are things like a Russian camera called the Quera. There was also something, a miniature Minox spy camera, and there was an American camera called the Stereo Realist, but there was no Imperial Reflex camera. That was not found, okay, until about the middle of February when Robert Oswald, who was living with Marina at that time, came over to Ruth's house, and Ruth gave him the Imperial Reflex camera. Kind of fishy? Yeah, I would say so.
But it should be said that there is nothing else about any of the rest of this, including the Paynes and their background and what they're doing, that would arouse any suspicion whatsoever.
Okay, now, let's go ahead and go to what I think is a very, very, very important piece of evidence that, again, I think I was the first one to really bring it out in all of its unbelievable background and provenance, right? This was a brown padded envelope that was in the so-called Nixie section of the Dallas-Fort Worth post office, which means it was not delivered for some reason. Okay? Now, it was addressed to Lee Oswald at 601 West Nassau Street, Dallas, Texas. The problem being that there is no such address. The problem with that is that it's very clear that that address sticker to that non-existent address is over another address, which the FBI never bothered to find out what the address underneath it really was. Now, you're not going to tell me they couldn't have found it if they really wanted to. All those guys working in their scientific department could have come forward with some kind of chemical solution that would have separated the address sticker so you could still read the address underneath it. Well, that didn't happen. There was also another problem, is that even though people were talking about this, and I'm talking about openly talking about it at a restaurant, November 23rd, across the street from the post office, the FBI did not spring into action until 2 weeks later. You know, it's almost like they wanted it to go away, all right, even though it had Oswald's name on it, all right? Now, there is a postmark on the envelope, which is not really legible, but that proves that somebody had tried to deliver it, okay? Now, the FBI said they couldn't find anybody who had handled the package, which, again, I find that very hard to believe, considering that Oswald's name was on it, all right? Now, what's really odd about this is that somebody cut off the end of the envelope, and what was inside appeared to be brown wrapping paper, okay? Now, if you recall, one of the accusations made against Oswald was that he brought his lunch to work in a very long bag the day of the assassination, which the Warren Commission said actually housed the Mannlicher-Carcano rifle. All right? Now, how does this all relate to Ruth Paine? On November the 20th, a package was sent from the Irving Post Office to Lee Oswald at 2515 West 5th Street in Irving, Texas. That is the address of Ruth and Michael Paine. It was not delivered at that time because there was postage due on it. On November the 23rd, the Dallas police searched Ruth's house for a second time, and they found the postage due notice with instructions to pick up and sign for the parcel. A deputy was dispatched to the post office, and the deputy said that the parcel had already been picked up, which is completely false because we know that it was still in the Nixie section, right? In an interview with Inspector Roy Armstrong, Ruth Paine tried to imply this was for magazines, which, of course, we also know is false, right? On November the 26th, the property clerk's invoice for the search of Ruth Paine's home, the following item appears. Postal form label bearing the name George A. Buhe, 4740 Homer Street, Dallas, Texas. Postal form bearing the name Lee Oswald, 112063. All right? Now, I don't know, to this day, I don't know what that means. Was Buhe sending something to Oswald? Or was Buhe sending something to Ruth Payne? And the two postage due things got mixed up for each other? Now, Buhe, as we mentioned in the last show, was a very heavy hitter in the white Russian community. But his name also surfaced in Marina Oswald's testimony to the Jim Garrison's grand jury in a rather odd way. Marina mentioned him as one of her English tutors in Dallas. Garrison asked if she knew that Buhe lived a door down from Jack Ruby, that they knew each other, and that they shared a common swimming pool. Marina said that she did know that, because right after the assassination, Buhe came to visit her. He told her that it was all just a coincidence that he happened to live next door to the guy who killed her husband.
Okay. Now, let me stop here just for a second, Jim, and recap some of what you have just told us. George Buhe, key member of the white Russian community in Dallas, inextricably linked with CIA, with the whole Galen milieu that we've spoken about, and was allegedly teaching Marina Oswald English. In our previous interview, it was disclosed that Marina apparently spoke very good English long before that. So what's happening there? Then a package is sent to Lee Harvey Oswald, courtesy basically of Ruth Payne, which was originally supposed to be delivered to a different address and then had a sticker over it. The FBI couldn't seem to decipher what the other address was. When opened, that package contained wrapping paper of the type that Lee Harvey Oswald is alleged to have wrapped around the Mannlicher Carcano to bring up to the Texas School Book Depository where he was working, because Ruth Payne got him that job from which he was supposedly doing this. And it turns out that George Buhe lives right next door to and shares a swimming pool with Jack Ruby.
Right.
And of course, this is all just a meaningless coincidence, and as Alan Dulles noted, well, you conspiracy people would have a field day with that kind of stuff.
Right. That's all accurate. Okay. Now, let me take it one step further, though. If the package would have been delivered, then when the police went to Ruth Payne's home, they would have found brown wrapping paper with Oswald's fingerprints on it. All right?
Yep.
Ipso facto, there is now the evidence that he was preparing that bag to go ahead and wrap the rifle in. All right? I've always believed that that was an utterly fascinating piece of evidence, and the whole thing about Buhe somehow being attached to the package in a very weird way was also utterly fascinating, plus the fact that you said that you just mentioned, and he just happens to live a door down from Jack Ruby. And then after the assassination, he told Marina that's all a coincidence.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And I want members of the audience to ask themselves even just one tiny aspect of this. When was the last time that either a member of the audience, sent someone a package containing wrapping paper, or when was the last time they had a package containing wrapping paper mailed to them? Leaving aside all of the other background information and, frankly, foreground information that we have spoken about, this, as with so many of the things that we have examined, makes no sense whatsoever on its surface. However, if we look at this as the development of an intelligence operation and a cover story for a covert operation, which really was a coup d'etat, the murder of the President of the United States, then it makes only too much sense.
Now, there is also the whole thing about how Oswald got his job at the Texas School Book Depository. Allegedly, what happened is that there was a gathering of some of the housewives in that area, and one of them said that her brother just got a job at the Texas School Book Depository. And Ruth Payne wrote that down, called the Texas School Book Depository, and talked to Roy Truly, the building supervisor, and then told Oswald about that job. And Oswald then went down to get it, and then he was hired within about, I think, 2 to 3 days after. But according to the Texas Employment Commission, where Oswald had been to try and find a job, he called the Payne household the day before Oswald got hired and told whoever answered the phone that he had a job offer for Oswald as a baggage loader at an airport that paid about 30% more than the job that he ended up getting at the Texas School Book Depository. He said he left a message, all right, with someone, said to do, and then he called back the next day, and the person now said that he had been hired at this other job, and so Oswald apparently never got the message. Ruth tried to say that it wasn't her that answered the phone, but later on, after questioning, I guess maybe it was me. All right? Okay, so there's another very interesting point to bring up about the whole association between the Paynes and Oswald. And I guess I should close that off by saying that Ruth and Michael Payne live in Santa Rosa, California. He passed away a few months ago, but they were supposed to have been divorced for a very long time, but they were still living in the same retirement center in Santa Rosa, okay, until he passed away. But she is still alive, okay? And so it's important, I think, to know that. Because I've always said this, that if there is ever going to be a reopening of this case, right, then she should be on the short list for people to go before the Dallas grand jury. So we can close that off right there with that.
It is, now bear in mind that, again, it was Lee Harvey Oswald's job with the Texas School Book Depository from which he allegedly fired the shots that killed President Kennedy. It was Ruth who got him that job, and yet when someone with a better paying offer called up prior to the acceptance of the job by Lee, she took it and apparently routed that off to the side. Lee never took that job, and of course, if he had taken it, he would not have been in position to have been framed for the killing.
Because that building, all right, that building is right at the intersection of Houston and Elm Street, okay? The presidential motorcade came down Main. It made a right on Houston. That's where the building is, all right? Then you go left on Elm, and that's where the parking lot for the building is, all right? So it put Oswald right there on the motorcade route.
Absolutely. And by the way, it's interesting who owned the building, too, although you don't make much of it, and you don't spend a lot of time on it in the book. Mr. Byrd, who owned the building, is not inconsequential to the whole milieu.
No. Byrd was an eccentric right-wing millionaire, all right, which I guess there had a lot of those people in Dallas, all right, and he was very much involved with the formation of something called the Civil Air Patrol. And I think everyone listening to this show knows that the Civil Air Patrol is the organization that through which Oswald met David Ferry in New Orleans. So make of that, you know, what you will. I will just say that sooner or later, with normal thinking people, when you keep on piling coincidence on coincidence, you know, the mind just kind of reels, okay, that many coincidences could happen in this case. But yeah. If you believe the Warren Commission, it did.
Yep, and we will talk more about Lee's trip to Mexico City, which figured very prominently in Jim Garrison's investigative hypothesis. But the silver bracelet that supposedly linked Lee and the Mexico City trip was found also as part of Ruth Payne's garage sale.
Right, right.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
We've been talking about the circumstances surrounding Lee Harvey Oswald and the creation of the legend of Lee Harvey Oswald, the Marxist Marine who defected to the Soviet Union with information about, you know, our aviation operations, including apparently the U-2, then comes back and he's hanging. I mean, just the altogether improbable network of individuals and institutions who would be the very last group of people and institutions with which Lee Harvey Oswald would be associated with, and in particular with the Paines, with their deep political background, their pedigree going back to the coalescing of the Northeastern elite. It's altogether improbable. Much of your book, the focal point of your book, is about New Orleans D.A. Jim Garrison's investigation into this, and yet another very improbable association of strange bedfellows for Lee as the anti-Castro Cuban milieu in New Orleans. We've spoken about that. Some will say more about that as we get into Jim Garrison's investigation. But in Destiny Betrayed, Jim, you talk about Jim Garrison's CV, his background. And in so doing, as we ease into Jim Garrison's investigation, you lay to rest two of the major brickbats that have been thrown at Garrison. One, that he did what he did because he was ambitious. He just wanted to make a name for himself and make money and so forth. And the other brickbat thrown at him was that he was some sort of flunky or shill for the mafia. And in outlining Jim Garrison's rise, his professional, really CV, his curriculum vitae, you basically lay those to rest. Tell us who Jim Garrison was and a little bit about his history.
All right. Jim Garrison was a child of a broken home. All right. His mother divorced his father because he was an alcoholic when he was about six. And she moved him from Iowa to New Orleans, where he's a pretty good student. And he went to Tulane's School of Law, and he got his JD. All right. He served in the military, and he had a very good opportunity to get involved with a high-class law firm when he got out of college, called Deutsch, Kerrigan, and Stiles, which is one of the big, what they call, white shoe law firms in New Orleans. He didn't like it. He thought it was boring. He quit, and he joined the FBI. When the Korean War broke out, he enlisted in the service, all right? But on his first day at Fort Sill, he began to suffer from battle fatigue from his earlier experience in World War II, and so he was dismissed in a couple of weeks. Returned to New Orleans.
Jim, let me jump in for just a second. I had another thought, although you don't go into this in your book. I have heard people with service backgrounds say, well, you know, Jim Garrison was not playing with a full deck. He was apparently suffering from PTSD, this, that, and the other thing. In World War II, Jim Garrison flew light unarmed observation planes that I've heard referred to as both bird dogs and grasshoppers. That kind of mission had an 80% casualty rate. In other words, it's like playing Russian roulette with one empty chamber. So it's not unsurprising that he would have sort of shaken up by that kind of service.
You're exactly, and by the way, that's how John F. Kennedy lost his brother, Joe Kennedy. That's what he died on, was on one of those missions. Because you had to get so close to the target, okay, to deliver the payload. All right, that's why you had that devastating fatality rate. They were more or less kind of suicide missions almost.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. And so Garrison was dismissed, and then he got a job in the city government running the traffic and safety division. And he did an absolutely splendid job there. Okay, they completely reformed all of the standards and practices. And the mayor of the town asked him, well, you did such a great job here. Do you want to be a judge? And he said, no. And he goes, well, what do you want to do then? You know, and he said, well, I'd like to work in the DA's office. So that's what he did. He went to the DA's office. And to show you the kind of guy Jim Garrison was, he had risen very high in the DA's office when there was an election held and there were charges of voter fraud, okay? And he had become the executive assistant to the incumbent. Garrison supervised the inquiry into the fraud charges, okay? And guess what? His investigation caused him to lose his position as executive assistant because he found out that there was fraud and a new guy came in and took his job. Okay? So he now... that happens a lot today, doesn't it, Dave?
Yeah.
Okay, especially in Georgia. All right. Now, Garrison now went into private practice, all right, and he decided that he was going to go ahead and make his own run for the DA's office, which he did, and he won, all right, in 1962. And he immediately, Garrison did, you know, I don't see how anybody can say that Garrison did not do a very good job when he was a DA for those 12 years, all right. He did a wonderful job, but there wasn't anybody who was going to be above the law with Jim Garrison. All right. He tried to prosecute police who beat up African Americans. All right. He refused to enter into an alliance with the Catholic Church. So if priests were found soliciting, you know, sex, he would bust them. Or he pursued illegal lottery operations. He brought a woman into his office. Okay. All right. So he was really a – and one of the highlight, of course, was his one-year crusade against the so-called B-girl drinking in the French Quarter.
Tell us what that was.
Okay. This was in the 60s and the late 50s. It was an operation in which the bar or the saloon would go ahead – and urged the bar girls to sit down with the client, have the guy keep on buying a bottle, and lure him with intimations that they would have sexual relations at a nearby hotel if he kept on buying. And the racket was that the girl would end up drinking watered-down drinks. As the guy got drunk, he would be more and more shortchanged, and the guy would become so bombed that they would have to call him a taxi to get him back to his hotel alive. All right. And of course, there was no, you know, the promise was broken. And this went on for years. And that racket was that the house got 2/3 and the girl got 1/3. Well, Garrison decided he was actually going to go after this. And he did. He was the first guy to actually break it apart. Okay, in a very well-organized, well-planned operation, okay, he would infiltrate these bars with people who worked for him. He did not trust the police because he thought they were part of the racket, right? And they would, you know, go in there and write up reports, sometimes record things, all right? And week after week, Garrison busted literally dozens of people, closed down numerous bars. Seven of them ended up being closed down permanently, all right? At its peak, Garrison shut down 9 clubs in 2 days, all right? That's how powerful his sweep was, all right? Now, it was because of this that he got in dispute with the judges because he had to prepare requests that they grant funds, and the judges thought that they were very clumsily held and that they would go to more than one judge, and he got into a dispute and he started criticizing the judges. All right. They decided to go ahead and sue him for libel. That case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. All right. And Garrison won. I think that was 1964. Okay. All right. So now, Garrison had become one of the most powerful politicians in Louisiana, and I'm not kidding about that, okay, because of all the notoriety he got for this crusade. He decided to back a dark horse in a 1964 governor's campaign, a guy named John McKeithen, and Garrison backed him to the hilt. He bought a full-page ad for him in the New Orleans Times-Picayune, and to everybody's shock, McKeithen won. So now, of course, if Garrison wanted to be, was so politically ambitious, he didn't have to do anything because McKeithen offered him the lieutenant governorship. And I interviewed Bill Alford, who was Garrison's assistant, and he told me one day he walked into Garrison's office. Garrison, this was during the Kennedy case, and Garrison was on one phone, and there was another phone in the trash can, and he could hear somebody's voice coming out of the other phone. And so Alford asked him, "Who's on the other phone?" And he says, "It's that McKeithen." And I go, "Okay," and Alford goes, "What's he want?" He goes, "He wants me to run for lieutenant governor with him." I go, "I can't be bothered with that kind of fanny-anny political stuff now that I'm on the Kennedy case." Now, I did some research on this. McKeithen won that year unopposed. So, in other words, Garrison would have been the lieutenant governor of Louisiana. Very easily then later become governor, and then his lifelong ambition to be a senator. He could, and he sacrificed all that. Okay, because of his devotion to the Kennedy case. But to show how grateful he was, McKeithen made other offers to Garrison. He offered him a state bank charter. You know, in other words, start your own bank. Garrison turned it down. The guy McKeithen actually gave it to then, you know, sold the charter in 1967 for $750,000, which would be today probably about $4 or $5 million. All right. But Garrison turned that down. He then offered him a job as a plum position as a legal representative in a savings and loan. That was like a desk job that would have, again, made him a lot of money. He turned that one down. Then he offered him state business as part of a large law firm that would then make him a managing partner when he retired. He turned that down. Garrison really liked being DA, you know. So that goes ahead and blows away all this other stuff about him being in the cahoots with the mob for money, okay, you know, because he had opportunities to be very extremely wealthy, you know, and he turned all those offers down.
And they one of part of the rap, the bad rap that has been put on Garrison is that he was ambitious, and yet he had an unobstructed path to higher office and material gain and sacrificed that. Garrison, one of the things about him, he was a Shakespearean scholar. And this brings to mind the famous passage in the tragedy of Julius Caesar. The men who assassinate Julius Caesar decide that they have to show solidarity, so they wash their hands and their daggers in Caesar's blood and smear it all over their clothes, and then they walk in with their bloody daggers and hands held high, covered with blood. And Mark Antony delivers his soliloquy over Caesar's body. And supposedly the assassins killed Caesar because of his ambition. And I'm paraphrasing here, but Mark Antony says, three times they offered him the crown, and three times he declined. But they said he was ambitious, and they are all honorable men. And he points to the conspirators who were covered with blood. And that comes to mind here.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Something else, Jim. On page 171, I'd like to read a paragraph that goes directly to and also foreshadows some of what we'll talk about in Clay Shaw's trial. The third paragraph on page 171, the references to vacation-minded judges, unquote, referred to the 2.5 months off the judges had in the summer due to a Louisiana statute which predated air conditioning. Although the air conditioning had been installed in the 50s, the judges still took the long vacation. The insinuation about racketeer influences had some underpinning. Two of Garrison's assistants had drinks with one of the judges, Judge Haggerty, note that, who would preside over the Shaw trial. Haggerty introduced them to Francis Giordano, G-I-O-R-D-A-N-O. Giordano was a Carlos Marcello associate. He complained to them that when Dowling took away their illegal gaming machines, he returned them. Garrison did not. How come? Giordano asked. That speaks for itself. Tell us what that tells us about Garrison and the other brickbat, one of the other brickbats thrown at him, which is that he was a mafia shill.
Right. Okay. Well, obviously, if he's not returning the pinball machines, that he's not hooked up with one. But the other guys were. You know, they were giving, you know, a kind of quid pro quo kind of thing. Also, even though Marcello was located in Jefferson County, Garrison actually launched a raid against his establishments in Jefferson, which is outside of New Orleans Parish, okay, because he wanted to try and push the Jefferson DA into doing something about Marcello. All right. Now, during those raids I talked about of the B-girl drinking,
yep,
several of those bars were owned and operated either by Marcello and or his associates. So this whole idea that somehow Garrison was in cahoots and his investigation was meant to cover for is, you know, it's nothing but baloney. Okay, I couldn't find any evidence of it. In fact, I found out evidence of the opposite. Okay, that Garrison actually tried to do something about Carlos Marcello.
Indeed, and people have suggested that the reason Garrison went after the CIA was to basically cover up for his mob buddies, and that is, well, it is simply put, a lie.
Right, exactly. And by the way, as is also the idea that he never investigated the mob, because I found a memo in which he did tell his assistant DAs to look out for evidence that implicated the mob. Okay? All right, so it's not like he didn't do that. He did.
He did, and it's also not like the mob and the CIA in the anti-Castro Cuban context are separate entities. They're by no means coterminous, but as we've touched on in the past, they did have a common interest in ousting Castro and reinstituting the status quo antebellum, so to speak. And so we spoke about Johnny Roselli and William Harvey. And so, you know, it would not be surprising that Garrison would have come across this. Jim, we have about 5 minutes left. Maybe before we talk about Kennedys and King and Black Op Radio, as background to the beginning of Garrison's actual investigation, JFK and Bobby Kennedy, the Attorney General, and the FBI were closing down some of the camps used for paramilitary operations against Castro. I wonder if you would synopsize that for us, and then tell us, again, we've got about 5 minutes left, tell us about Kennedys and King, where they can get your books, and Black Op.
After the missile crisis, and Kennedy had made a deal with Khrushchev, all right, that they were not going to try and overthrow the Castro regime, Kennedy and his brother, Bobby, began to go ahead and shut down a lot of the training camps, all right, which were mostly located in the southern rim of the United States, all right. And they got together sometimes with the Coast Guard, all right, sometimes with the FBI, to go in and bust these guys. And the Cuban exiles and the mob now began to get the message that, all right, it looks like, you know, any hope that we have of overthrowing Fidel Castro by these guerrilla operations is now a thing of the past. And there was a lot of complaints about this. I mean, a lot of complaints. But that's how determined the White House was to go ahead and keep their word after the missile crisis. All right. And so Kennedy now became very, very unpopular, you know, with both the Cuban exiles and the mob, which, of course, wanted their saloons back, you know, in Havana. All right. And so now there began to be other elements that the Cuban exiles went to for funding. The radical right, you know, in Texas, you know, like the Hunt brothers, the Murchisons, things like that. And also some of the mobsters now began to put their own money in. But the Kennedys kept on cracking down on those training sites. Very interesting element, I believe, of what's finally going to happen.
Indeed, and we will take up with the genesis of Garrison's investigation. David Ferry, as we have seen, one of the people involved with those camps. And we will begin really recounting what Jim Garrison was looking into and how he did it in our next interview. This, however, concludes, or almost concludes, For the Record 1038. Jim, tell us about your website. Tell us about where they can order not only Destiny but Trade, which would make an excellent holiday gift, but also JFK, The Evidence Today, and where they can hear Black Op Radio.
All right. The website is called KennedysandKing.com, and you can punch through there. There's links to both books, Destiny Betrayed and The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. And I'm also a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's podcast called Black Op Radio, which you can look up on the web.
All righty. And remember, it is, as we record this on December 4th of 2018, holiday gift giving season, and I hope we have given listeners some serious thoughts about gifts for the information-minded on your shopping list, so to speak. This concludes For the Record program number 1038, interview number 8 with Jim DiEugenio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on December 4th of the year 2018. For Jim DiEugenio, this is Dave Emery saying ciao.